And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you along with Bonnie Berman. Well, today we visit with Paul Shapiro of the Humane Society of the United States. He's the Vice President of Farm Animal Protection. Many people choose to eat no or less meat for many reasons: health, environment, and animal welfare. School districts are serving less meat in cafeterias, including Miami-Dade and Broward counties. Paul Shapiro joins us now from Washington, D.C. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Joseph. How are you doing? Hello, Bonnie.
Very well.
Hi. Pleasure to have you. To begin, I just want to say...
Thank you for having me.
Well, great to have you. We're not asking folks to completely cut out all animal products today or to become vegan. What we're looking at is eating fewer animal products and eating with greater consciousness and humanity. Is that correct?
There is a trend going on throughout the United States, and as Joseph mentioned, in Florida especially, but throughout the United States, where people may not necessarily be becoming vegetarians or vegans, but Americans are eating less and less meat. In fact, from 2007 to the present, meat consumption in the U.S. has plummeted by more than 12%. And the polling is very fascinating on this, because you would think, well, if less meat is being eaten, maybe more people are becoming vegetarian. Well, some people are vegetarian, about 5% of Americans are, but 16%, far more, report that they eat vegetarian more than half the time. So these so-called flexitarians, the people who are a bit more flexible with their diet, they don't feel the need to eat meat every meal or every day, these are the people who are really driving this change in the American diet, so much so that we as a nation are eating more plants and we're eating fewer animals. And that's good, certainly, for public health. It's good for the environment, and it's good for animal welfare.
Tell us a little bit more about these ag gag bills in state legislatures, which shield meat production from the public eye and reporters.
Thanks, Joseph. Well, this is one of the reasons why people are reducing their meat consumption, is because the meat industry is trying so desperately to keep Americans in the dark about how animals are being treated inside of these industrial animal factories, as well as inside slaughter plants. Groups like the Humane Society of the United States have been engaged in whistleblowing expose after whistleblowing expose at these factory farms, documenting how animals raised for food are so routinely abused. And the meat industry's response to these exposés has not been to try to prevent the abuses from taking place. Rather, it's been to prevent the American people simply from finding out about these abuses. What they want to do is blow the whistle on the whistleblower by trying to pass legislation that would make it a crime just to take a photo or a video of what happens to animals on factory farms. In fact, Florida was the very first state in the nation to introduce this type of legislation to ban photography at factory farms. Then Senator Jim Norman was the sponsor of this bill in Florida. Fortunately, Florida's legislature had the wise sense to kill the bill, but other states have taken it up. And it shows just how desperate the meat industry is to hide its practices when they want to make it a crime to engage in whistleblowing at their facilities.
So are these ag gag bills curtailing the activities of the whistleblowers and those trying to document the cases of all forms of animal abuse?
Well, fortunately, most of the states that have considered this legislation have rejected it. There have been a couple states like Utah, Iowa, and Missouri that have passed these, and where they are really trying to criminalize whistleblowing. You got to keep in mind, these whistleblowing exposés have led to so many reforms. So, for example, the Humane Society of the U.S. has done investigations that have led to slaughter plant closures, criminal convictions for animal cruelty, even meat recalls, new congressional hearings, new federal policies on the ways that farm animals are going to be treated. And looking at all of this, the meat industry has decided that rather than clean up its act, it just wants to suppress these whistleblowers. And it's both animal welfare whistleblowers and it's food safety whistleblowers as well. In fact, one of these investigations in 2008 at a Southern California dairy cow slaughter plant led to the largest meat recall in U.S. history because of food safety concerns that the Humane Society of the U.S. had exposed. And that's one reason why the meat, egg, and dairy industries are so desperate to continue keeping people in the dark. And this is one reason why more and more Americans are looking at this and thinking, is this an industry that I really want to be supporting when I sit down to eat three times a day?
I understand that the Iowa legislature is even fighting against schools having these meatless Mondays.
Well, fortunately, they're having much less success there, but many schools and school districts, including some in Florida, are now promoting Meatless Monday. This is a public health campaign designed to help reduce incidence of obesity, heart disease, diabetes, various cancers, and more. We're seeing study after study showing that there are real benefits to eating more plants and eating fewer animals. And these schools are also doing it as part of a green initiative, because producing meat requires far more resources than producing plants. And so simply by cutting back on meat, by engaging in, for example, a Meatless Monday, these schools can both go green and can also improve childhood health at the same exact time. And so we're seeing this real increase in desire to do this. For example, Los Angeles Unified School District, the second biggest school district in the country. They serve 650,000 meals every single day. Every Monday now, all of the meals they serve are vegetarian. Now, they're not asking the kids to become vegetarian. They're just saying, on Mondays, let's make it a green day, and we're going to make it a meatless Monday.
We're speaking with Paul Shapiro. He's the Vice President for Farm Animal Protection at the Humane Society of the United States. If you'd like to join in the conversation, questions or comments, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. Paul, as difficult as this may be, would you tell us about some of the cruel practices of factory farming, the transporting of animals, the slaughter, and the conditions under which the animals live and die?
Sure. Thanks, Bonnie. Most people are unfortunately not that familiar with how farm animals are treated. And so just to give a few examples, if you take the case of egg-laying hens, most of these birds who we use for egg production are confined in what the industry calls battery cages. These are small wire mesh cages that are so cramped that the birds are unable even to spread their wings. Each bird has less space than a single sheet of paper on which to live for more than a year before she's slaughtered. It really is difficult to imagine a more miserable existence, yet more than 9 out of 10 egg cartons that you would find in the supermarket come from birds who live in this state of perpetual immobilization. Similarly, in the pork industry, as a matter of routine practice, millions of pigs are locked inside of what are known as gestation crates. These are small, 2-foot-wide cages, barely larger than the volume of the pig's body, in which she is unable even to turn around for nearly her entire life, which can last for years. And so here you have a social, intelligent, 500-pound animal immobilized in a cage that, again, is barely bigger than her own body. And then we take thousands of them and we line them up like parked cars and subject them to that type of torment. These are the types of tortures that we wouldn't inflict upon the most heinous criminals amongst our society. Yet these animals, the chickens, the pigs, and other farm animals, have committed no crime. They have done nothing to deserve these abuses that we're forcing upon them. And yet we treat them, again, worse than we would treat the worst criminals in our society. It makes no sense. We need to move toward a more humane society in which our relationship with these animals contains a little bit more compassion and respect and a little bit less violence and domination.
When we're in the supermarket and we see free range labeled on, say, chicken or turkey, can we really believe that that's true? Or what's the distinction between free range and not?
It's a great question, Joseph. Thanks for asking it. Well, most times when you see the term free range, what it means is that the birds at least were not in cages. As far as egg-laying hens are concerned, that's an improvement. It's better than being locked up in a cage. But free range doesn't necessarily mean that the birds were outside on a pasture or had any type of real meaningful outdoor access. It's defined as basically saying they have access to the outdoors. So it doesn't necessarily mean they even were outdoors. It just means they had access to some type of outdoors area There's no specificity as to how much outdoor space, what type of outdoor space, the frequency of the access to the outdoor space. So you could have some free-range operations where you have tens of thousands of animals in a warehouse where essentially none of them really go outside, or you could have other free-range operations where the animals really do go outside, but just the term free-range alone isn't enough to differentiate between those in the marketplace.
So how does one eat eggs consciously, for example, just eggs for now?
Well, the Humane Society of the U.S. has a great guide. If you just go to our website, egglabels.com, again, that's egglabels.com, you can see exactly what the variety of labels in the marketplace mean and, frankly, what they don't mean. There's a dizzying array of these animal welfare labels in the marketplace, and it can be very difficult for the average consumer to know what they all mean or don't mean. And so the Humane Society tries to make it easy for people to understand what it is that they all mean at that website, egglabels.com. Also, there are a lot of people who are reducing the number of eggs in their diet, or some people aren't eating eggs at all. And so you see people, in fact, Google is now just documenting this, that more and more people are doing searches for things, for recipes and other information about eating an egg-free diet and a dairy-free diet and so on. So there's an increasing consciousness about not only how these animals are treated, but also looking for alternatives to reduce our consumption of meat, eggs, and dairy, too.
It's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Paul Shapiro. He's the Vice President for Farm Animal Protection at the Humane Society of the United States on today's Topical Currents. We need to take a short break. We'll come back and take some calls.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Paul Shapiro of the Humane Society of the United States. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. And email, that's radio@WLRN.org. First up, we have Dee. She's in Hallandale Beach. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The question is for Mr. Shapiro. In reference to the meatless meals, are these meals primarily plant-based or starch and sugar-based? Because I know many vegetarians, I was a vegetarian, but I ate plants. Many vegetarians eat too much starch and too much sugar, which may be even more detrimental to health than meat. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks
okay.
so much for your call, Dee. You raise a very important point. And, you know, most starches they do come from plants. I mean, potatoes are plants, for example. But at the same time, you raise the important point that in order to gain the many of the type of health benefits of this type of eating, it really is important to eat more fruits and vegetables, more whole grains, and try to minimize processed foods. But at the same time, when we eat more of these whole plants, they can tend to crowd out the meat, the eggs, and the dairy, so that we end up reducing the amount of animal products we're eating and increasing the amount of whole foods, plant-based diets that we're consuming. So these schools that are doing Meatless Monday, many of them have very good menus where they have, for example, Southwest bean and rice burritos, or they have marinara sauces that are chock full of vegetables over a bed of whole wheat pasta. Those are the type of things that many of these schools are doing and are being received very well.
I wanted to mention when I was preparing for this program, one of the pieces of literature Richard gave us gave this staggering statistic that Americans, if they skipped one meal of chicken per week, the benefits, it would be the carbon dioxide savings would be the same as taking more than 500,000 cars off U.S. roads. Just skipping one
Amazing.
Chicken meal. Yeah, so I wanted you to talk about some of the environmental benefits of a more plant-based diet.
Thanks so much, Bonnie. That's an amazing statistic. It's from the Environmental Defense Fund. And basically, the reason why that is, I mean, keep in mind, they're not even talking about a meatless Monday. They're just talking about a 1/21st reduction, just not eating chicken, one meal and substituting vegetables, 500,000 cars. It's the CO2 equivalent on the savings there. So what they mean by that is that animal agriculture is a leading cause of climate change in the world. In fact, the United Nations estimates that animal agriculture is responsible for about 1/5 of all greenhouse gases in the on the planet. And so when we think about climate change and we think about ways that we can combat it, we think about maybe driving less, or we think about turning the lights off when we're not in a room, we ought to also be thinking about what type of food we put on our plate. Perhaps we ought to be thinking more about what type of food we put on our plate. This is one of the reasons why the United Nations now has one of their top recommendations to celebrate what they call the World Water Day, a day to conserve water, is not just to take a shorter shower, but it's to eat less meat, because the meat industry is one of the leading users of water in the entire world. So it's important that from a climate change perspective and from an environmental perspective that we reduce the amount of meat we're eating. Right now, Americans eat per capita among the most meat per person in the entire globe. And we are suffering as a result of it, not just environmentally, but as far as public health, certainly animal cruelty. And it's a win-win for us to start bringing down those per capita consumption numbers.
For those who want to consume animal products more humanely and ethically, how do we know when animals have been raised, transported, and slaughtered humanely, and if their meat is sustainable? How do we know? Do you have a website for that as well, or are there labels in the store?
There are no shortage of labels, Bonnie. HumaneSociety.org/labels gives the explanation of what all of them mean, and there's really too many to enumerate here right now, but the point is that some of them have higher standards than others. Some of these programs have very high animal welfare standards. Other ones have very low animal welfare standards. But, you know, when we look at the broad range of the options available, what we're seeing is a real shift from people who are reducing their consumption of animal products and people who are seeking to treat farm animals better, too, not just on an individual level, but even many of the biggest food buyers in the country. So, for example, we were talking about earlier the confinement of pigs in these cramped gestation crates where they can barely move an inch their entire lives. Some of the biggest pork buyers in the country, like McDonald's, Burger King, which is based in Miami, and others, are now telling the pork industry that they want them to phase out that practice. Now, many of them have quite lengthy multi-year phase-out plans that they want to engage in, but the point remains that many of these most inhumane systems on factory farms are being targeted by the biggest buyers of these products, saying that they too want reform, not just as individuals, but as institutions, as corporations, that they too want to see animal welfare improvements made.
If we cut down our meat consumption or eliminate it, what are the alternate sources of protein?
Great question, Joseph. Really great question. There is no shortage of protein in the plant kingdom, whether we're looking at protein from beans, which are quite high, protein from whole grains, also another great source of protein, or proteins from foods like tofu, tempeh, seitan, and then also the increasingly popular plant-based meats that are out there, products like Gardein, a great product. It's spelled G-A-R-D-E-I-N. It's made primarily from a blend of pea protein and soy protein. It tastes very much like meat as if it were from animals, but it's just meat from plants. And it's extraordinarily high in protein. So whether you're eating a bean and rice burrito, or whether you're eating nuts and seeds, which also have a good amount of protein, or whether you're eating some of these plant-based meats like Gardein, Boca Burgers, other products like that, tofurkey is another great one. There is no shortage of protein out there to get from the plant kingdom.
What about the soy-based fake meats like Bubba Burgers and soy bacon? Aren't they really highly processed and a lot of chemicals to add that mock flavor?
Well, it's not so much that they have a lot of chemicals. I'm sure there may be some brands that do, but other brands like Gardein and Tofurky and Field Roast, these are great products that really aren't that processed, and especially they're not that processed when you compare them to many of the meats that are out there in the marketplace right now. We have to keep in mind that most farm animals are doused. They're doped with non-therapeutic antibiotics as a means to keep them growing faster and faster. Many of them are given hormones like pigs and cattle. We also give them all types of other drugs in these animals' feed and sometimes even in their water. And so there's no shortage of unnatural and possibly unhealthy additives in the meat supply as well.
Alicia sent an email. She says, changing your diet is the most impactful thing you can do, more important than the car you drive or the light bulbs you use. My favorite saying, a vegetarian who drives a Hummer is greener than a carnivore who drives a Prius. That's from Alicia.
That's really funny. That's very funny. Well, thanks so much for the email. And there's certainly, of course, truth in jest. And I think that it's important for us to recognize that if we are concerned about protecting the planet, then we need to look beyond just what type of a car we drive or whether we drive. We need to look especially at our food choices. It's because we can make this type of an impact every single time we sit down to eat, three times a day, or for some of us, like myself, even more than that. We have the option to build a more humane society, to be healthier ourselves, to have a healthier planet for us to live on. And it's such an easy thing to do. And it's probably the most delicious way to take a bite out of global warming,
Paul,
just by eating.
We're very short on time. I'd like to squeeze in another caller. This is Diego in Miami. I'm short on time, Diego. Hi.
Yes, I just wanted to share my experience. I switched my my diet to a whole foods, plant-based diet, and just my energy levels, overall health performance in sports. And, you know, it's just very easy. Anybody can do it. You know, it's just a matter of adapting your taste buds and you know, just give it a try. You know, it's not that hard. Just do your research, do your homework, and it's very easy. Anybody can do it.
Thanks, Diego. Paul?
Thank you.
Thanks. Diego, that's a great comment. Thank you so much for sharing it.
I wanted to ask you about fish. We haven't mentioned that.
Sure. There are so many problems with the way that we are fishing the oceans right now. We're depleting the oceans of fish, so much so that many of the fisheries and our ravenous appetite for these aquatic animals is really causing not only tremendous harm to the fish, obviously, but it's also causing harm to the aquatic ecosystems that our planet's life is dependent on. And so when we talk about eating a meat-free one day a week, we're talking about not eating any animals that day. We're talking about, for example, not just not eating chickens and pigs and turkeys, but fish as well. And so it's important that we look at the issue holistically and recognize that there are real benefits by eating plants and by trying to reduce the number of animals who we're eating too.
Paul, once again, how about some websites where people get more information about eliminating or reducing meat in their diet?
Well, there's a great resource if you're interested in Meatless Monday, whether you want free recipes, videos, toolkits, and more, is just humanesociety.org/meatlessmonday. Again, humanesociety.org/meatlessmonday.
Thank you very much, Paul Shapiro.
Thank you, Joseph. Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you so much. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. Chip Kidd is a rock star in the world of book jacket design. Prominent authors pressure their publishers to hire him. Some of his work has become iconic, such as the T-Rex silhouette for Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park. But Kidd also has the dubious distinction of owning one of the largest private collections of Batman memorabilia. In his graphic novel, he brings together his two passions, art and superheroes. Batman, Death by Design, follows the Dark Knight as he investigates a mystery involving an architectural landmark in Gotham City. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Kidd. He began by asking him why a psychotic who dresses like a flying rat has had such a lasting hold on American culture.
I would define it less that way than... Why is reinventing yourself after a terrible tragedy taking such a hold on American culture? Because that is American culture. And, you know, I don't want to get too highfalutin here, but or pretentious. But, you know, America sort of came about by redefining itself. It wasn't the annex of Britain anymore. It was its own identity. And I think on a metaphorical level, that's part of why Batman is so enduring in his popularity. This is about somebody who had something horrible happen to them at a very young age, And instead of giving in to despair and sort of curling up in a ball and rocking back and forth in the corner, they decided to take charge of their lives and reinvent themselves as this completely different thing. So I think that aspect of the Batman story is tremendously appealing to people. And it's escapist fantasy. He's, you know, his greatest superpower, frankly, is money. And everybody loves that. And that grants him tremendous freedom to do this. And so it's really less about, you know, psychotic flying rat than it is about reinventing yourself.
Well, Bruce Wayne seems fairly normal in your book.
Yes.
Sure, he's still avenging his parents' murder, but he's not the crazed brute.
Correct.
That was popularized by Frank Miller.
That is very correct.
In The Dark Knight Returns. Were you trying to make The Dark Knight a little less dark?
Well, I think, you know, I loved what Frank Miller did. Huge fan, obviously. I worked with him when he wanted me to redesign it and all of that, and that was great. For my book, I wanted to go back to aspects of Batman when I was a kid that I really liked, which it's great to be, like, you know, fearsome and not campy or silly, but at the same time, I'm not interested in a Batman or a Bruce Wayne that are constantly questioning themselves and questioning what they're doing. That's not interesting to me. This is the way it is, and it's important that he can be Bruce Wayne when he needs to be Bruce Wayne and get things done in that sector and that sphere. And then when that's not working anymore, then he becomes Batman and does what he can do as that character. And that works really well for me. And it's a very much a yin and a yang that's in balance. And, you know, it's just more fun for me as a kid when he's functioning this way. It's not dysfunctioning.
We're speaking with Chip Kidd about his graphic novel, Batman, Death by Design. Batman made his first appearance in 1939. Your book is drawn in black and white. Is this a homage to Batman's Depression-era beginnings?
Very much so. Absolutely. And it's also a kind of wish-fulfillment fantasy of, I wish, you know, they would have made a really great Batman movie in the 30s with high production values. And, you know, I looked at it as what if Fritz Lang would have taken this on and made Metropolis into Gotham. And the artist, Dave Taylor, really, really came through. And he's the one that had to make this all happen on the page. And I think he did a great, great job.
You drew this book, but you didn't write it? Or
no, I wrote it, and I art directed it.
Uh-huh.
But no, he drew it.
He drew it.
I laid out the panels. In other words, I broke down on a page the grid of the panels and what was happening in them. There's many different ways that you could write a comic book script. Most comic book writers do it almost as if it's like a screenplay, where they're not necessarily breaking it down for the artist. They're just saying, all right, this is what has to happen on this page, that this character is going to say this character is going to say this, and by the time we get to the end of the page, this is where we are, next page. I went a little farther than that, and just because I didn't really know how else to do it. I knew visually how I wanted the panels to break down on any given spread, and the artist actually really liked that because it gave him more structure.
Well, tell us something about the plot. What mystery does Batman have to solve in your book?
Well, I started thinking about, well, what story could I tell that, I mean, every Batman story has been told. And I started thinking about the fact that I live and work in New York City, and I have for 26 years and counting, and I love it. But what sort of kind of urban injustice do I encounter, I'd say, on a at least weekly basis all the time? And that, to me, was having to go in and out of Penn Station, train station in New York City, all the time. I'm traveling up and down the East Coast all the time for business and travel and what have you. And so I'd much rather take Amtrak than fly. And I love Amtrak when it works. But if you're going to take Amtrak in New York, you have to use Penn Station. You also have to use it for a lot of other reasons, too. But when you see the glory that was the original Pennsylvania Station building, McKim, Mead & White, that was designed, I believe, in like some 1905 or something, and then it was demolished in 1963 and basically replaced with Madison Square Garden, and then Penn Station was relegated to basically be the basement underneath Madison Square Garden, and, you know, with airless and low ceilings and fluorescent lighting, and that's a true crime that they allowed that to happen. And so that's one aspect of the story, is that you have Wayne Central Station, which is this sort of grand, old, wonderful building, but it's crumbling and falling into disrepair, and it's been marked for demolition as the story opens. And in real life, after the only good thing to come out of the demolition of the Pennsylvania Station was that a bunch of people in New York woke up and said, okay, we need a landmarks commission so that this doesn't happen again. And another building that was marked to be torn down in the 70s then was the Grand Central Station. And one of the chief people who rose up against this was none other than Jackie Onassis. She was a real pioneer in saving that building. So I created this character named Cindy Asil, who's named after my aunt, who plays that role. She's trying to save the Wayne Central Station. And Bruce Wayne actually is in favor of demolishing it. And part of that, the reason for that, which he cannot articulate, is that he wants to build a covert travel hub underneath that site so that the Batmobile can get anywhere in Gotham it needs to underground, and then build a new station on top of that. And of course, he can't say that. So in Cindy's eyes, he's sort of callously, flicking away the memory of his father, who built this amazing building.
Well, accidents take place, lives are placed in jeopardy. But what comment, if any, were you making about modern architecture? Because it's an architect in the novel that is very creative, but he seems to be the butt of a lot of jokes.
Yeah.
Were you doing your own version of From Bauhaus to Bauhaus there?
I'd say I probably was. The architect in the book is called Kem Roomhouse, and I think if you know anything about contemporary architecture, you know who I'm talking about there. And I think the new train station that he designs and presents to Bruce Wayne, which again, Dave Taylor had to actually design it, is beautiful. I mean, it's really kind of great. I think I'm mocking just pretension there in general, the way he describes his work and a way a lot of architects describe their work to me has nothing to do with the actual work. Even if the buildings are great, all that architecture speak or art speak to me can be really rather silly. I'd say, though, what I'm sort of critiquing here more than the architectural process is the building trade in New York. And so once I established kind of what the story was going to be about, the other main factor in this story that was taken from real life were these massive construction crane collapses in Midtown Manhattan in spring of 2008, which were truly astonishing. I mean, those were literally, disasters in broad daylight in which, 8 and 9 people died, and it happened again, and it happened again after that. And it's really all about graft. It's about paying off the inspector to look the other way, and about mounting your crane on the side of the building as opposed to anchoring it to the ground like legally you're supposed to. So the thing ends up toppling over. And
well, that's what happened at the storm lately.
Yes, and that was two blocks from my office, and so they cordoned off our building for 2 days. We couldn't go in, not because the loss of power at all, but because we're worried that this great bloody crane's gonna fall on you.
so
that's very shady too.
Okay, well, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Chip Kidd. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and you're seeing Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is author and illustrator Chip Kidd. In his latest graphic novel, Batman Death by Design, The Dark Knight tries to solve a mystery involving an architectural landmark in Gotham City. Chip, Batman is not the only superhero here. There's a masked vigilante named Exacto.
Yes.
Exacto shares similarities with Batman. They're both geniuses suffering from childhood traumas.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with this character?
Well, again, you know, DC Comics really gave me extraordinary freedom to create characters if I wanted to, which was tremendously exciting. And so I created, you know, the Gotham Gazette newsroom, and there's a reporter and there's his boss and all of that. And then the heroine, Cindy Isill. But I wanted to create this new sort of anti-hero or villain or whatever you want to call him, Exacto. And of course, that's a takeoff on the name of an Exacto knife. But although his character has nothing to do with knives, I just think the name Exacto sounds really cool and nobody ever took it. But he's sort of what I call Batman villain as architectural critic. And so you are correct. He is, you know, when you finally get to his backstory, you sort of understand who he is and where he's coming from. But as he makes his first appearance, he basically sort of magically appears at these certain, at the openings of these new structures and basically says, you know, this is not built correctly and it's about to crumble. And so then it does. And so you're led to question, well, did he make it do that or did it just do that because he's right? And then I guess I don't think I'm giving anything away by the fact that he sort of appears and disappears mysteriously, and you finally start to understand that he's a hologram and that he's projecting himself from another place. And I love that idea that there's the story is sort of divided in two, and there's a cliffhanger sort of in the middle where everybody is kind of trapped at the top of this construction crane that is about to go over, basically, because it's been timed to do so, and everybody's trapped on it. And, you know, Batman says to Exacto, well, aren't you forgetting something? And Exacto says, I better not be. And he said, well, you're going to die here with the rest of us. And he says, well, no, because I'm not actually here. And then he literally turns himself off and disappears. And that's, you know, that's sort of the magic of comics in this particular genre of comics.
I won't give away Exacto's secret identity.
Right.
But his face looks awfully familiar. It's quite memorable. I don't even have to close my eyes. It's as if I'm staring at it right now. Why did you use your own image for Exacto? Were you fulfilling a childhood fantasy?
I would say I was. Absolutely. I mean, not that I dreamt of being a Batman villain as a kid, but, you know, I started thinking about, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to do this again or get this opportunity, and it was only about a third of the way into the process that I said to the illustrator Dave Taylor, I said, oh my god, you know, Exacto should be me. That character, his secret identity should basically be me at around age 25-26. And so I sent him a bunch of photo reference, and he very kindly obliged. That was, I sort of like, I couldn't resist doing that.
We're speaking with Chip Kidd about his graphic novel, Batman Death by Design. Batman and Exacto both have to battle the Joker.
Yes.
Thanks to Jack Nicholson and Heath Ledger, the Joker is almost as famous as Batman.
Right.
How did you envision him?
I envisioned him as a version of his original inspiration in the comics, which was a silent movie actor named Conrad Veidt, V-I-D-T, in a movie called The Man Who Laughs. And this is, of course, like everything else, all over YouTube if you want to see it. And it really is kind of wonderful and uncanny. It's like seeing the Joker in a great German expressionist, a silent film from the late 20s. And he really looks like the embodiment of the way he was originally drawn in Batman number one, which is to say, you know, he's a clown, but he's very frightening. And especially like with the bags under the eyes and very sort of, you know, a grin, but a horrible grin. And so my instructions to Dave Taylor was to draw him that way. But Dave did a wonderful job with his wardrobe. He's really sort of, he's very dandy and dressed up to the nines. I think, not that I really have a problem with the Heath Ledger Joker at all. I think it's a wonderful take on the character, obviously. But to me, the Joker was always very put together, from the makeup or whatever it is to what he's wearing. He's not a bum, and he's not careless about his appearance that way. And again, that's just sort of like a great affectation of that character from that time.
Well, the interesting thing about Batman's villains is that they're all emotionally or psychologically damaged. Two-Face is schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. Catwoman's a kleptomaniac. The Joker is a psychopath, clearly.
Yeah.
Can you name another superhero with so many twisted villains?
Oh, golly. Well,
because in a sense, they're projections of Batman, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think, if anything, a lot of the criticism of certain Batman films or Batman projects is that, you know, the danger of making this stuff is that the villains can take over, literally, and become more interesting than the hero. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that is something to be wary of, because Batman is very interesting to me. So he shouldn't play second fiddle to, but of course there's more of them than there are of him, which is part of why Robin and then all the Batgirl and all the quote Batman family grew, because I think they needed to counterweight all of these wonderful villains. Most of the well-conceived and well-drawn, superhero, characters have wonderful villain casts. Certainly Superman does, certainly Spider-Man does, the X-Men do, although it starts to get more complicated with that particular mythology, and you know, as we will see, you know, the Avengers, there's all sorts of stuff to, you know, they all sorts of wonderful villains.
Well, you mentioned Robin, Batgirl, Commissioner Gordon. None of them appear in your book. Why
Correct.
Did you leave them out?
I left them out because I only had so many pages to work with, and I introduced these new characters, and you know, I just sort of had to draw the line. I mean, I love Commissioner Gordon, but there was no effective way to bring him into this. He's mentioned at one point. Harvey Dent is mentioned at one point, just to acknowledge that they're there. But no, and like, you know, like you said, this is very much an homage to Batman's original appearance, and Robin didn't show up for about a year and a half. So I will say, I'm probably not supposed to talk about it, but I don't care, and it's not that big a deal. But I've written a new 8-page Batman and Robin story for DC Comics for a backup feature for one of their upcoming titles, and that was a real kick. I mean, it's so different than Death by Design. It's a really classic Batman, and Robin is 10 years old, and it's about when Robin meets Superman for the first time.
Well, that relationship between Batman and Superman is interesting. Didn't you write a Superman-Batman story?
For Alex Ross, yeah.
For the great, you know, comic book illustrator.
Yes, for a book called Mythology.
And for a long time, I think since Frank Miller, there's been very great antagonism between these characters.
I've never understood that.
But you disagree.
I totally disagree.
Yeah.
It's like saying that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson are at each other's throats. You know, I don't get that either. To me, it's Pollyanna, but I grew up with when these characters, quote, were friends. And that just makes so much more sense to me. You know, you could go into all sorts of geek theories about, you know, it doesn't really make sense for Batman to be pissing off Superman because he'll crush him like a bug. But that's a whole other issue. That's a logistical issue. I just think it's far more interesting for them to be compatriots. Although, you know, the Alex Ross story, which was a joy to do and watch him paint, he's a genius, was about the idea, okay, what happens when Superman is suddenly inexplicably out of control and Batman has to stop him? You know, how does he do that? And you know, there is a way, but he's doing it not to destroy him. He's doing it just to stop him and help him and fix him. And that just makes so much more sense to me.
Well, Batman's costume has undergone many changes over the last 70 years. Mm-hmm. How did you see his costume? How did you...
I really wanted to keep to just the basic classic costume to the extent that the bat symbol on his chest, we went back to just a stylized pair of bat wings, which speaks to the symbol that was on his chest in the very first story, The Case of the Chemical Syndicate in Detective Comics number 27. And that lasted all of one issue. The next issue, 28, there was a little head attached to the bat symbol. But other than that, I wanted to keep it really old school classic costume.
And no nipples.
No nipples. I have to say, even though as much as I love Christian Bale and Christopher Nolan, the Batman as commando suit just doesn't work for me.
Thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Chip Kidd.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. His book reviews run in the Miami Herald, and he blogs on the Huffington Post. And that wraps up this hour. It was produced by Richard Ives, technical direction by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Also, more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program looks at the personal finance industry with journalist Helene Olin. The gurus we encounter on TV, radio, and seminars have a dark side and often offer misleading advice. And now today's calendar on this day in 1917, 96 years ago, the birth of longtime Florida Congressman Dante Fussell in Bridgeton, New York. He picked up a UM law degree in 1938, was in combat in World War II, and served a mere 38 years in the U.S. House. And on this day in 1954, 59 years ago, the first local color TV commercial airs on WNBC New York. It hawked Castro decorators. One more while we remember the American Family Association and the Corcoran Gallery of Art. On this day in 1989, 24 years ago, the death of legendary photographer Robert Mapplethorpe in Boston of AIDS-related causes, age 42. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. And we leave with a thought from Mapplethorpe, who used a Polaroid for his first photos. Quote, "I went into photography because it seemed like the perfect vehicle for commenting on the madness of today's existence." This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.